From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
And this is Michael Moore filling in for Peter Jennings this morning.
Today, Michael Moore joins us live in the studio. We'll talk to him about his endorsement of Wesley Clark, his comments about Mumia Abu-Jamal in his book, Dude, Where's My Country?, and other issues that listeners and viewers have raised around the country. But first, we'll take a look at the new Watergate. Republican staff members of the Senate Judiciary Committee infiltrated opposition computer files for a year, monitoring secret strategy memos and periodically passing on copies to the media. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. CIA officers in Iraq have warned the Bush administration that a civil war may break out in Iraq. According to the Knight Ridder News Agency, the officers delivered this verbal warning earlier this week. The situation was discussed by President Bush, his top national security aides, and Paul Bremer, who is heading up the U.S. occupation. One senior official told Knight Ridder that regional experts in the State Department and National Security Council agree with the assessment, which is far bleaker than anything the administration is publicly discussing. One intelligence officer said, quote, both the Shiites and the Kurds think that now is their time. They think that if they don't get what they want now, they'll probably never get it. Both of them feel they've been betrayed by the United States before. The head of the U.S. Army, General Peter Shoemaker, has said the so-called war on terrorism has benefited the U.S. Army by making it more focused and giving it some oomph. He told the Associated Press, quote, there's a huge silver lining in this cloud. War is a tremendous focus. Now we have this focusing opportunity. We have the fact that terrorists have actually attacked our homeland, which gives it some oomph. Shoemaker said it was no use having an army that did nothing but train. He said, quote, there's got to be a certain appetite for what the hell we exist for. The Toronto Globe and Mail is reporting that the only reason the U.S. detained and jailed Canadian citizen Maher Arar in 2002 was that he was an acquaintance of two men under investigation for ties to terrorist organizations. Arar was detained during a stopover in New York. He was then secretly sent to Syria, where he was jailed for a year. On Thursday, Arar filed a lawsuit against the U.S. government. He alleges the U.S. sent him to Syria with foreknowledge that he would likely be tortured. The Globe and Mail obtained U.S. documents that showed the regional director of the INS made the determination that Arar was a member of al-Qaeda after he admitted he knew two suspected terrorists. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to hear an extensive interview with Maher Arar. Time magazine is reporting a grand jury began hearing testimony on Wednesday in the investigation of who leaked the identity of CIA operative Valerie Plame to columnist Robert Novak. Plame is the wife of former Ambassador Joseph Wilson. Plame's identity was leaked shortly after Wilson came forward questioning claims by President Bush about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Democratic Senators Patrick Leahy and Joseph Lieberman have written to Supreme Court Justice William Rehnquist to question the appropriateness of Justice Antonin Scalia spending several days recently with Vice President Cheney killing ducks. Their trip comes at a time that the court is deciding whether to force Cheney to open up records from his energy task force. The senators asked Rehnquist to send them information on the court's rules about justices recusing themselves from cases where, quote, their impartiality might reasonably be questioned. In South Dakota, former Republican Congressmember and Governor William Janklow was sentenced Thursday to 100 days in jail for causing a fatal car accident in August. He killed a motorcyclist. He had faced a maximum of 11 years in jail. Interior Secretary Gail Norton has approved a plan to open nearly 9 million acres of wilderness on Alaska's North Slope to oil exploration. The Los Angeles City Council voted 9-2 to pass a resolution Tuesday night to support legislation that would repeal parts of the USA Patriot Act. More than 235 communities have now passed such resolutions that condemn the act. And the Senate voted 65-28 to approve a $328 billion omnibus spending bill after Democrats abandoned a fight to take out several controversial provisions regarding overtime, the nation's media ownership, and gun records. One provision would allow the Bush administration to rewrite the nation's overtime laws that could strip up to 8 million workers of overtime pay. Another part of the bill would require federal officials to destroy records on gun purchases within 24 hours of the purchase. The current law requires the records be kept for 90 days. A third provision would relax media ownership laws to allow major networks to own more TV stations. And the Wall Street Journal is reporting Halliburton is admitting to the Pentagon that two of its employees received kickbacks worth up to $6 million from a Kuwaiti company that received an Iraq reconstruction subcontract.
Old pirates, yes, they rob I, sold I to the merchant ship. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever had, redemption songs, redemption songs.
Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Some say it's just a part of it. We got to fulfill the book. So won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever had.
Johnny Cash and Joe Strummer singing Bob Marley's redemption song. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
And good day to all of our listeners and viewers around the country. And we're going to start with one segment about something that sounds familiar in political circles. The Boston Globe is reporting that Republican staff members of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee infiltrated Democratic computers files for a year, monitoring secret strategy memos and periodically passing on copies to the media.
From the spring of 2002 until at least April 2003, members of the GOP committee staff exploited a computer glitch that allowed them to access restricted Democratic communications without a password. They were able to read talking points and accounts of private meetings discussing judicial nominees and which ones the Democrats would fight and what tactics they would use.
The Office of Senate Sergeant-at-Arms William Pickle has already launched an investigation into how excerpts from 15 Democratic memos showed up in the pages of the conservative-leaning newspapers and were posted to a website last November.
We're joined on the phone now by Charlie Savage, who is the Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe. Well, can you lay out your findings? It's good to have you with us. Can you tell us what you have found out?
It is the Wall Street Journal editorial page and the Washington Times, which is also a conservative-leaning paper, and they related Poster to a website. And so that's what became the leading edge into the question of how these memos had been obtained and what the background of that was. And we hadn't heard much about that since November, when one Republican staffer was suspended pending the outcome of that investigation. And what I've now learned is that this was not an isolated incident. Rather, this revealed that something that was a pervasive practice for at least a year, could be longer, but I nailed it down to be at least a year, in which a computer glitch was discovered by several Republican staffers that allowed them to access the private files of Democratic staffers and basically placed them under surveillance in the sense that they knew what they were saying to each other, they knew what the speeches and the talking points they were preparing for closed-door meetings that were coming up, they knew the private meetings they were having with outside groups that were also working on the judicial nominee issue, who did a lot of the research for Democrats and would say, you know, here's the 100 judicial nominees President Bush has made, you know, here's the ones we think you should target, and here's why, and for filibustering and trying to block. And this just went on for a year without anyone knowing about it, and no one would have ever known about it except someone then passed on several of these memos to these media outlets, and suddenly we all knew about it. But even though only 15 of them were initially thought to have been compromised, now it looks like hundreds or even thousands of files must have been trolled through to obtain these 15, because these 15 weren't just sort of sitting there. They were selected out of a much larger pile.
And one of the journalists who ended up getting some of the information is another familiar face, a source of or recipient of Republican leaks, Robert Novak, right?
Well, Democrats certainly have a very, very strong suspicion that these memos, some of these memos, formed the basis for a column that Novak wrote in February of last year, which was called Ted Kennedy's Grand Design, and it detailed their plan to filibuster certain judicial nominees coming up, which hadn't been done before. And indeed, that is what played out in the course of 2003. It named them, it described what he was saying as he exhorted his colleagues to join him in this sort of rather extraordinary escalation of how they would attempt to fight certain nominees they saw as leaning too far to the right. At the time, I'm told, they were confused about how he could be quoting things that went on in these meetings, and especially like even small meetings, meetings with only a handful of senators just sitting in someone's office. It seemed unlikely that Robert Novak, who's a conservative pundit, would have sources among the liberal left on Capitol Hill who would tell him these things. Once it became revealed that these memos had been compromised, they were able to go back and see that three memos in particular, talking points prepared for Ted Kennedy, and accounts by some other staffers for another senator who couldn't make that meeting but had sent a staffer to describe what happened, pretty clearly corresponded precisely to what Novak was saying had gone on. And Novak, for your listeners, is also at the center of a very high-profile leak investigation right now involving a July column of his in which he revealed that a woman named Valerie Plame was a covert CIA agent, thereby essentially ruining her career. And her husband was an ambassador who had accused the Bush administration of lying about Saddam Hussein's nuclear capabilities based on an investigation they had sent him on to Niger to see if Saddam was buying yellow cake uranium there, which he said no, they weren't, and then it ended up in Bush's speech that they were afterwards. So the inference is that someone in the White House had planted that fact, Valerie Plame's identity, in Novak's column as a retribution.
Charlie Savage, I'd like to ask you, I mean, what's illegal about this? Or is there anything illegal or unethical about this?
Well, we got to wait until the investigation that's been launched by the Senate Sergeant-at-Arms Office is complete before we know all the facts. However, there is a legal and ethical guideline context that this is going to play out in. There is, for example, a law called the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which was originally passed in 1984 and has been updated several times, which criminalizes accessing a government computer when you don't have the authority to be there, or even if you do have the authority to be there, exceeding your authority. So Republican staffers who were the ones who actually went on their desktops and clicked on this, on these files on the shared server that were supposed to be password protected that had other people's names on them, are going to have an uphill battle convincing investigators, I suppose, why that did not constitute exceeding their authorization to access a government computer. And it's interesting that even though this investigation is not complete, in fact, I'm told 3 or 4 weeks maybe before it's done, already some outside conservative...
Charlie Savage? Are you there?
Oh, I'm sorry. Am I there now?
Yes, you're there.
Okay. Already, even though this investigation is not complete, already some conservative Republican groups, namely the Committee for Justice, which is headed by a former White House counsel from the first Bush administration, are preparing talking points, which are almost like a summary of a legal memo, almost a synopsis of all the different laws that could, or and ethical guidelines that could be implicated by the situation, and arguing why these were not. It would be inappropriate to bring charges under this one and that one and the other one. And it seems to be sort of a preemptive effort to head off what their own research indicates may be triggered by this once all the facts are in.
With the help of forensic computer experts from General Dynamics and the U.S. Secret Service, you write that the Office of the Sergeant at Arms, Mr. Pickle, is interviewing about 120 people and sees more than half a dozen computers, including four judiciary servers, one server from the office of Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist of Tennessee, and several desktop hard drives?
That's correct. That's to date the scope of the investigation. Well, since it's not done, more people could be added to that list, more computers, I suppose. The reason for pulling the servers from the Judiciary Committee is obvious. That's where the computers were compromised. Probably those servers would have evidence of, you know, which computers were accessing which files when. And the pulling the server from Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist's office was done because one of the people who has been publicly named as involved in this is a former Judiciary Committee staffer who now works in Senator Bill Frist's office as his prime advisor on judicial nominees. And the name of his computer hard drive was stamped across the bottom of one of the memos that was posted to a website in November. So that memo was an email from an abortion rights group as opposed to an internal correspondence. So he argues that he doesn't know how that memo ended up with the other one. So I suppose they pulled that server to see if he also was accessing something.
Well, Charlie Savage, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Charlie Savage is a Washington reporter for the Boston Globe, has exposed the story of Republican staffers in the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee spying on Democratic staffers, computer files, for a year, monitoring secret strategy memos and periodically passing on copies to the press. And we'll continue to follow this story. Do you think it could be as big as Watergate?
Well, I think that's probably a little bit of an exaggeration. We're not talking about a president here, for one thing. Secondly, there has not been any indication to date that any elected officials, any senator, knew about this. If that were to change, it could become a bigger deal. At this point, though, the prospect is staff that no one's ever heard of, maybe getting fired, maybe having to face some criminal.
But once one memo after another started coming out, and they were coming out in the press, and certainly the Republican senators were reading them, weren't they asking some questions of their staffers like, where did you get this? And then this, and then this, and then that went on for a year.
Well, again, you're assuming that the Republican senators knew that those memos were floating around and forming the basis of the earlier media reports, like the Novak column. Certainly in November, when it blew open, when several of those computer, when the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Times or had these excerpts and said these are excerpts. Judiciary Committee Orrin Hatch, who is a Republican from Utah, immediately seized, ordered all these servers seized and held for Pickle's investigation, and he also launched his own sort of preliminary investigation, and it was he who announced in November that at least one person was going to be suspended. It was he who pointed out that someone who used to work for his committee, who is apparently this person who now works for Frist, was involved. And in fact, he used language such as, he said he was mortified that this improper, unethical, and simply unacceptable breach of confidential files may have occurred on my watch. So at this point, if indeed that was when Senator Hatch first learned of it, Democrats at this point are saying that his response has been completely straight and narrow and improper.
Charlie Savage, thanks for being with us. Oh, you said but?
Pleasure. Well, I was going to say, if it were discovered that anyone knew about it earlier and did nothing, that could change the situation.
Thank you. Charlie Savage of the Boston Globe. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, Michael Moore and the presidential debate last night between Democratic candidates. Stay with us. Yes, that's Elmore James, Standing at the Crossroads. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Last night, the remaining Democratic candidates had their final debate ahead of next Tuesday's New Hampshire primary. The last week has seen a tightening of the race. The latest ARG poll has John Kerry at 31%, Wesley Clark 20%, Howard Dean 18%. Means from January 19th to January 22nd, Dean fell from 28 to 18%. In the last 24 hours, Dean dropped 4 percentage points, of course, though, from Iowa. Can you believe the polls? This past weekend in New Hampshire, Wesley Clark got a boost from Academy Award-winning filmmaker Michael Moore, who endorsed Clark at a campaign rally at Dartmouth College.
Issue after issue after issue when it comes to the working people of this country. He comes forth last week with a tax proposal that says no family under four who's earning less than $50,000 a year will pay a dime in federal income tax. They need our help. They're the working poor of this country. They're the working people of this country. But that wasn't enough. He could have just left it there. Well, that sounds good. Let's just give a huge, great tax cut to those who are the working people of this country. He could have just left it there, but no, he says, and on top of that, if you make more than $1 million a year, you're gonna pay 5% more in income tax. He sucked it to the rich. He sucked it right to them. He didn't have to do that. It's absolute. Issue after issue after issue. I couldn't believe it was this good. It was this good. And that we have been handed a gift. A 4-star general, head of his class at West Point, Rhodes Scholar, captain of the debate team. And I know you're thinking what I'm thinking, right? I want to see that debate. I want to see that debate! Oh, yeah! I want to see that debate! Oh, boy. That's right. The general versus the deserter. That's the debate. That's the debate we want to see.
And that was Michael Moore at Dartmouth College endorsing General Wesley Clark. Special thanks to Corey Boutillier of the independentfilm.com for providing that footage. Well, last night, Michael Moore's comments came into the presidential debate that was held in New Hampshire as Peter Jennings questioned General Wesley Clark.
General Clark, a lot of people say they don't know you well, so this is really a simple question about knowing a man by his friends. The other day you had a rally here, and one of the men who stood up to endorse you was the controversial filmmaker Michael Moore. You said you were delighted with him. At one point, Mr. Moore said in front of you that President Bush, he's saying he'd like to see a debate between you, the general, and President Bush, who he called a deserter. Now, that's a reckless charge, not supported by the facts, and I was curious to know why you didn't contradict him, and whether or not you think it was would have been a better example of ethical behavior to have done so.
Well, I think Michael Moore has the right to say whatever he feels about this. I don't know whether this is supported by the facts or not. I've never looked at it. I've seen this charge bandied about a lot. But to me, it wasn't material. This election is going to be about the future, Peter. And what we have to do is pull this country together. And I'm delighted to have the support of a man like Michael Moore, of a great American leader like Senator George McGovern, and of people from Texas like Charlie Stenholm and former Secretary of the Navy John Dalton. We've got support from across the breadth of the Democratic Party because I believe this party is united in wanting to change the leadership in Washington. We're going to run an election campaign that's about the future. We're going to hold the president accountable for what he did in office and failed to do, and we're going to compare who's got the best vision for America.
Let me ask you supplementary then, because since this question and answer in which you and Mr. Moore was involved, you've had a chance to look at the facts. Do you still feel comfortable with the fact that someone should be standing up in your president and in your presence and calling the president of the United States a deserter?
To be honest with you, I did not look at the facts, Peter. You know, that's Michael Moore's opinion. He's entitled to say that. He's not the only person who said that. I've not followed up on those facts. And frankly, it's not relevant to me and why I'm in this campaign.
And that is General Wesley Clark being questioned by ABC's Peter Jennings last night at the Democratic presidential debate in New Hampshire. Academy Award-winning filmmaker Michael Moore joins us in the studio. Well, where were you when the debate took place and you heard your name invoked?
I was sitting at home eating a slice of pizza. and I saw that happen. First thing that caught my attention was Peter Jennings pronouncing my name in the Canadian, you know, the way Michael Moore. I think that's just about all that's left of his Canadianness, though. What a pathetic question. And then for him to say that it was a reckless charge, not supported by the facts. Well, the facts are all there. The Boston Globe, again, on May 23rd of 2000, did an excellent investigation about Bush and how he skipped out on his service to the Texas Air National Guard. Washington Post did a story, New Republic, TomPaine.com has all of this on there. My website has all these stories. You can go to it, all the links are there. You can read all the sordid details about how Bush went missing for up to a year, maybe longer. At that time, Senators Max Cleland, Daniel Inouye, and Bob Kerry held a press conference demanding to know where Bush was, and pointing out, as Inouye said, if I had done this, I would have been court-martialed. If I had done this, I would be in prison. Bush was not able to present any documents or any proof showing where he was during this time that He essentially got off from the Air National Guard to go work on a campaign that his dad wanted to work on in Alabama.
We have the Boston Globe piece right here. It says, after George Bush became governor in 95, the Houston Air National Guard unit he'd served with during the Vietnam War years honored him for his work, noting he flew an F-102 fighter interceptor until his discharge in October 73. And Bush himself, in his 99 autobiography, A Charge to Keep, recounts the thrills of his pilot training, which he completed in June of 1970, saying, I continued flying with my unit for the next several years, but both accounts are contradictory by copies of Bush's military records obtained by the Globe in his final 18 months of military service, 72 and 73. Bush did not fly at all. And for much of that time, Bush was all but unaccounted for. For a full year, there is no record that he showed up for the periodic drills required of part-time guardsmen.
Right. Even his own commanders said, we never saw the guy. And when he was supposed to be in Alabama, the Alabama commander said, I absolutely zero recollection of this guy ever showing up, ever. For Peter Jennings, just to make a statement of fact like that, that it was a reckless charge, not supported by the facts are all there. What's reckless is that Peter Jennings and the mainstream media, for the most part, with a few exceptions like the Boston Globe, don't do their job, don't follow through. And when information is reported, drop the story as quickly as they can. Just some of the stories you mentioned this morning here about Halliburton, you know, and then all this stuff. You know, this will be in the news for a day or two, and then nothing will happen. These people commit these crimes, and then they just go scot-free. I thought Clark, you know, handled it well. I mean, he's, you know, doesn't really, I think, want to debate this issue from the past because there's so much going on right now. The real issues are how Bush is AWOL right now on so many of his responsibilities to the people of this country, and that, you know, that really is what we should be talking about. But it was just interesting watching. I was watching all the pundits afterwards trying to turn me into the sister soldier of this election. You know, Clark must distance himself from this man. especially the Fox, the Fox Nuisance Channel, man, there, that is just a piece of work. You have to, I think in my mind, it has surpassed Comedy Central and The Daily Show as the funniest thing on television. I just turn on the Fox News Channel. And,
like fair and balanced reporting.
Yeah, he's just a knee slapper, one thing after another. Chris Matthews last night said this is going to be the big story for the next couple of days. You know, will Michael Moore be repudiated?
On the bigger issue, as you say, yeah, of your endorsement of General Clark, I saw that debate as well, and It was clear to me that, especially on the issue, again, of the war, that General Clark still has a lot of difficulty being able to explain his position, his position on the war. Could you talk a little bit about what made you decide to endorse him?
Sure, sure. we're in very difficult times right now. That's how I look at the situation. I'm not a Democrat. I don't support the Democratic Party. have said for a long time what I think about them. They're a nicer, kinder version of the Republican Party, and sometimes not so nice and not so kind. We have someone in the White House right now that has to be removed, absolutely has to be removed. And I think that there is a general consensus on this. How do we do this? How do we do this? Well, clearly for me personally, Al Sharpton and Dennis Kucinich are people that I, you know, agree with, I think, probably on all the issues. Dennis Kucinich and Al Sharpton are not going to be the next president of the United States. Sometimes it's important to vote, to make a statement, to make a point. Certainly many of us who were involved in the Nader campaign in 2000 felt that way. We sat there and watched Al Gore in that second debate with George W. Bush agree. They agreed with each other 39 times on the issues. It was absolutely disgusting. But I think early on in 2000, most people thought, you know, Gore, you know, running on peace and prosperity and incumbency, would probably be the next president. But that we couldn't allow that to happen without a strong showing from the left, letting him know that he wasn't going to have the support, and we needed to push him to take better positions. I think that's why a lot of people initially got involved in the Nader campaign. And Ralph had made the commitment to, you know, he wasn't going to focus on the swing states that could throw the election. He was going to, you know, we were going to go to these other states, get the 5%, get the Green Party on the ballot. Once Gore actively prevented Nader from participating in the debates, which was absolutely wrong, Ralph then decided to change his tactics and decided to go to the swing states to hurt Gore. People involved in the campaign, such as myself, decided to get off the bus at that time. And I said to Ralph at the time, I said, you know, after this election, we're going to have to work with these Democrats. You know, not everybody is where we're at. And yet we exist in what I believe is a majority liberal mainstream in this country. As I say in my book, with all the poll statistics, you can see that the majority of Americans are very liberal on the issues. Whenever they're asked about choice, about the environment, about gun control, affirmative action, gay and lesbian issues, go down the whole list, the majority come down on the good side. So we need to figure out how to coalesce and how to bring together that majority so that we actually, you know, get some power in this country and make some good things happen. And as I explained in Stupid White Men, I went down to Florida on my own once Ralph decided to go to the swing states and conducted my own campaign to tell voters, look, I'm voting for Nader in New York, but that's easy for me to do. That's not going to, you know, put Bush in office, but you have a different job here, and that's to stop George W. Bush. So, you know, I'm the kind of person who believes that there's a part of your voting that has to be purely on principle, and there's a part that has to be on strategy. And with Clark, that's pretty much what it comes down to. Dennis and Al Sharpton are not going to get anywhere near the White House. So who then becomes the most left of the candidates? And even as the New York Times pointed out last week, Clark, if you look at his positions, is actually to the left of Dean. And you know, I have, you know, problems with Dean and all this, but I don't really feel like attacking him. I think the poor guy has been through enough this week. I can go down a whole list of things where I think Clark is very strong in terms of being pro-choice, pro-environment, pro-labor.
Michael Moore, yeah. Let's play a clip from the debate. And this was the questioning of Wesley Clark by Fox's Britt Hume.
That you're a good guy, but he thinks you're a Republican. Now, we're told you did vote for several Republican presidents, President Nixon, President Reagan, said good things about the first President Bush, and even about this President Bush. You said in an article published in the Times of London back in April as the war ended, quote, "Liberation is at hand. Liberation, the powerful balm that justifies painful sacrifice, erases lingering doubt, and reinforces bold actions. As for the president, you wrote, quote, President Bush and Tony Blair should be proud of their resolve in the face of so much doubt. Given those statements, given your votes, I think it is not unreasonable to ask you when you first noticed that you were a Democrat.
Well, actually, Britt, I did vote for Al Gore in 2000 for Bill Clinton in 1992 and 1996. But when I was in the military, I was not a member of any party. I was an independent, and that's the way it is done in the state of Arkansas. And when I got out, I looked at both parties. And I'm a fair-minded person. And when the President of the United States does two things that I agree with, one of them attacking the Taliban in Iraq, and the other is not quitting in the military force, in the use of military force in the middle of a dust storm, then I'm going to say so. And when I'm president, I hope that Republicans will praise me when I do things right.
Well, that's the only
But can I just finish my statement?
Please.
I'm running for president because I don't like the direction George Bush has taken the country in. I am a Democrat, And I want to turn this country around and set it going in the right direction. I want to put a strong basis of values back into this Democratic Party and take George Bush head on, because family values is our issue in the Democratic Party. It is not the Republicans' issue.
Could not a reader be justified in concluding from this piece that you wrote for the Times of London in April that you did indeed support this war and was pleased by its outcome, and as you said the first time when asked the question, probably would have voted to support it?
No, that's not true. In fact, if you look at the whole article, what you'll see is that the article lays out a whole series of tasks that have to be done later on. And it's written in a foreign publication. I'm not going to take U.S. policy and my differences with the administration directly into a foreign publication. But I made it clear in the article, and I think you've got it there, if you'll read it on down, you'll see that I say this doesn't mean they've got to focus now on the peacekeeping, the occupation, the provision of order. There's a whole series of tasks that I laid out for them to do that, in fact, they were incapable of doing. I did not support this war. I would not have voted for the resolution. But once American soldiers are on the battlefield, then I want them to be successful and I want them to come home safely.
Thank you, General.
An excerpt of the Democratic presidential debate last night in New Hampshire, Fox's Brit Hume questioning Wesley Clark. We're going to get Michael Moore's response when we come back from our break. Stay with us.
Listen to me. Don't try to buy no home down in Washington, D.C., because it's a Bush war town. Ooh, it's a Bush war town. I got a Bush war blues on going on. Red and yellow all around. Me and my sweet wife and Miss Barnacle run all over that town. Everywhere we go to people, they would turn us down. Lord, in a Bush war town. Ooh, it's a Bush war town. I got the Bush war blues, I'm gonna. Red and yellow all around. Some white folks in Washington, they know just how. Some of colored man a nickel just to see him by. Lord, in a Bush war town.
Bourgeois Blues, Lead Belly, and Woody Guthrie here on Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest is Academy Award-winning filmmaker Michael Moore, won the Academy Award for Bowling for Columbine. His latest book is Dude, Where's My Country? Can you respond to, Britt Hume's questions of General Wesley Clark, but also our listeners called in with their major concerns were two. One was your endorsement of General Wesley Clark, and the other we'll get to in a minute and had to do with what you wrote about Mumia Abu-Jamal in your book. But let's hear from our listeners.
Hello, my name is Mason Gaucher. I live in Eugene, Oregon. I listen to 88.1 KWVA, and this is the question is for Michael Moore. I had just heard that you support Wesley Clark, and I want to know why the hell you do that.
Hi, my name is Sonny Rosen, and I'm calling from Los Angeles, California. I listen to KPFK 90.7 FM. And my question for Mr. Moore is, since you've apparently made your endorsement choice well known by backing Wesley Clark, I wonder if you're aware that your candidate has been a huge supporter of the infamous School of the Americas. Publications like CommonDreams.org and the New York Post document how Clark testified before Congress to fight the attempts to close it that were being led by none other than Representatives Kucinich and Gephardt. While I, too, am seriously troubled by some of the positions of each major candidate, from Edwards and Kerry's support of the Patriot Act and the Iraq invasion, when it mattered most, to Dean's desire to keep the military spending in excess of $400 billion, can you really endorse a candidate who repeatedly calls the sole mission of the SOA the promotion of human rights? No show has done more to prove this assertion utterly false than Democracy Now!, so can you possibly explain your stance in light of these facts here on their airwaves? Thank you.
Two of our listeners representing a lot more of the people who called in.
The other show that has taken on the School of the Americas was my show, TV Nation. I went down there. I've been very involved against this. Clark's position, as stated last week, not from some quote from back whenever that was. Again, in the Boston Globe, when he was asked about this last week, he said that if anyone can bring forth any abuses or show anything that the new school, because it's no longer the School of the Americas, you know, they closed it down by an act of Congress, reopened it under a new name. If anyone can bring forth any abuses since this has happened, I will be the first one to shut down this school. I then contacted the School of the Americas Watch and the people involved in the campaign that I know and asked them to put together the abuses since the reopening of the school. And I will present them to Wesley Clark. And I'll right now take him at his word that if this is proven to him that he'll support the you know, the closure of the school. He also said in the same article, why doesn't anyone call for the closing of the Harvard Business School? Because he said he could make the point that the graduates of the Harvard Business School have perhaps caused even more death and destruction and chaos and poverty around the world than the School of the Americas. I thought that was kind of an interesting idea. Never really thought of it. And I'd like to encourage all of my fellow comrades in the fight against the School of the Americas to join in that fight, too, which maybe I'll just initiate myself, the closing of the Harvard Business School.
But on the issue of the war, while he's called the anti-war warrior, I mean, he was on CNN all the time. Yeah. It surprised many to hear him characterize afterwards, since he was on the record almost 24 hours a day, to hear that he was anti-war, castigating countries to get on board, castigating the United Nations to get on board.
Yeah. I think he is, again, in the mainstream of where most Americans are at. Believe that Saddam Hussein was a bad guy, and most Americans actually take the word of their president when he tells them there's weapons of mass destruction. That's why there was the polls long before the war started. The people were clearly against this war in the United States. And then once the war started, the people then were behind the war. If we're going to go and convince people that this has to stop and that we can't go into any other wars like this again, we need someone who is really of them, who can take that message to them. You know, as good as I may think my skills are, or how I wish, you know, Pacifica and this show was in every single market in America and everyone listened to it, you know, the reality is that he's closer to them than Michael Moore or Amy Goodman. And so if he's willing to take his four stars and go out there in middle America and explain why this war is wrong and why we should never go to war and that should only be as a last resort, that's a very powerful thing. You know, it doesn't bother me. Like people say, well, you know, he voted for Republicans or he was a Republican or whatever. You know, he voted for Reagan. And I, you know, my attitude is, yeah, the majority of Americans voted for Reagan. You know, where I come from in Michigan, all these blue-collar Democrats who voted for Reagan, you know, that we have one of them on our side now, that he's switched, that he can then take that message to them, that's a good thing. You know, this is why we lose so many times is because, you know, we get up on our high and mighty horse, you know, it's like, nope, not pure, can't come, oh, he voted for Reagan, oh, he's, you know, has a position I don't like. You know, the other side, the Republicans, the right-wingers, you know, they welcome anybody to come over. Reagan was a Democrat. Reagan voted for FDR. You know, the Republicans didn't go, Reagan voted for FDR. Oh, can't come in. He's a commie. No, they were like, welcome. Welcome and bring millions with you. You know, and we're like, You know, we have got to start having the attitude that we've got the big tent. And we want everyone in the tent. Not just the Michael Moores and the Amy Goodmans and the people who listen to Democracy Now. We want the people who voted for Reagan. If you voted for Reagan or Nixon, if you supported this war at one time, welcome. Welcome now. If you've changed your mind, welcome. You know, this needs to be our attitude if we're going to win. George McGovern and Gene McCarthy voted for the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. George McGovern and Gene McCarthy led us into Vietnam. George McGovern and Gene McCarthy are in part responsible for the deaths of 58,000 American kids and 3 to 4 million South Vietnamese. Do we hate George McGovern and Gene McCarthy? Or did we say when they finally decided to change a few years later, welcome, thank you for coming out against the war.
thank you for running for president. That was our attitude. It took McCarthy and McGovern, a couple of years to figure it out. It took people like Wesley Clark just a few months to figure it out. Once you figure it out, I say welcome. And if you'll go out there and be the fighter for us and try to bring down Bush along the way, and you do all these other things too, you know, he's on the cover, Clark is, of The Advocate here this month, wearing a white T-shirt, it looks like, and a leather jacket. Basically saying if he were president, he'd throw out this don't ask, don't tell business. It's absolutely trash. And that he would not get in the way of any state who would want to pass a civil unions or gay marriage or whatever you want to call it act. This is how he is on these. To me, the way I look at this is look, he's not me. I don't agree with him on everything, but if this isn't like Gore, I mean, this is the good thing about this election year, is that actually all of these candidates are to the left of Gore in 2000. Actually, Gore this year is to the left of Gore in 2000. It's a good thing. They're not everything we want them to be, but we're not having to compromise, for less than 50% of what we want. We can get 60, 70, 80% of what we want with many of these candidates. And I think with Clark, we not only can get that, but we can win. Because if I can just say this one, this election is going to come down to 15 states. One of those states is not New York. It's not California. It's going to be those 15 swing states. It's going to be a small percentage of votes. That's what's going to determine whether George Bush gets another 4 years. And you look at the map, you see what those states are, and you have to honestly ask yourself the question, who stands the better chance of beating Bush in Florida? Who stands the better chance of beating Bush in West Virginia, in Nevada, in Arizona, Ohio, Missouri? Look at the map. That's the central question. And as difficult as it may be for some of us on some of these issues that we don't like, especially, say, with Clark, we have to say, he is our best chance. He is very good on these issues. Here's University of Michigan, the affirmative action case. Here's something. I mean, he filed an amicus brief with the Supreme Court in support of the University of Michigan's case. He doesn't just, mouth these liberal platitudes. He actually walks the walk. He actually does things that he doesn't really have to do. I mean, why does he want to get involved in affirmative action, 59-year-old white guy? Well, because he is involved because he's an American, and we all benefit when we reach out a hand to those who have been traditionally discriminated against.
I want to get to, before the end of the program, another issue that people have raised around the country since your book came out, Dude, Where's My Country? And that is the issue of what you said about Mumia Abu-Jamal in the book, saying that you felt he was guilty. Let's just hear a few listener comments.
Oh, I didn't say that, though.
Why don't you explain what you said?
Yeah, before you. First of all, it's in a satirical chapter called "How to Talk to Your Conservative Brother-in-Law," and I'm going through a whole bunch of ideas on how to convince that knucklehead down at the other end of the table at Thanksgiving dinner why he should maybe see things our way. And as certain icebreakers, I say, you could say to him, why don't we just admit some of the things, maybe that we're wrong about, and that will get him to open up. And so I go down this, this whole list, and clearly, at least to me, it was tongue in cheek. Some people have taken this though completely literally, and I'm, I feel bad about that now, because you shouldn't make light of somebody who's on death row and is, could die. And I say in the book, why don't we just say to your conservative brother-in-law, Mumia probably killed that guy, and then I say, I don't know if he did or didn't. What I do know is that he didn't get a fair trial, and he deserves a new trial, and neither he nor anyone should be executed. That is the bottom line with everything. And then I go on to say, tell your conservative brother-in-law that, teenagers shouldn't have sex. And then I say, maybe I'm just saying that because I didn't have sex until I was 32. Clearly, I hope that people understand that was a joke and that I actually, had sex by the time I was 31. But, having said that, though, I've received a lot of letters, and I feel bad because this is a man's life we're talking about. And sometimes with comedy, it's a fine line between, do you take it too far? And maybe I took it too far in this case. That's how I feel about it.
This is what some of the listeners said.
Hi, Michael. I'd like to thank you for your work. In your latest book, Dudes, Where's My Country, you twice said Mumia probably killed that guy, and once that those defending him, quote, may have overlooked the fact that he did indeed kill that cop, unquote. I am convinced that not only did Mumia get this glaringly unfair trial, but also that Mumia is indeed innocent. Are you aware of the Columbia University Law School study that showed that at least two-thirds of all people on death row are either innocent or that there's enough evidence of innocence that if they did receive a fair trial, they'd be released?
Hi, my name is Catherine. I'm calling from Oakland. I listen to KPFA, and I am calling to ask Michael Moore what he was thinking when he mentioned Mumia in his book, that Mumia probably did shoot the guy. And I'm sure he has a reason for it, but I'm sure you've gotten many calls regarding this issue and whether he felt like it was really necessary to use a man's life to make the point that he was trying to make in that chapter of his book.
Yeah, I'm very good calls, and I hope my explanation suffices there. I've been very active in the past in calling for a new trial, opposing his execution. I continue to be that way. Do you know who Nicholas Yaris is? You ever hear of Nicholas Yaris? Anybody listening ever hear of Nicholas Yaris? He's another death row inmate on the Pennsylvania death row, along with thousands of others who are on death row in this country. Except Nicholas Yaris was exonerated on December 9th. He was let go from the Pennsylvania death row because he didn't commit the crime. It turns out since Pennsylvania has reinstituted the death penalty in 78, they've executed three people but exonerated five. So there's almost been twice as many people found to be actually innocent who are going to be executed than the number of people they've executed in Pennsylvania. My point is that we need to know about not just the Mumias, but the Nicholas Yarises, the other people who are going to be executed. If you live in California or anywhere actually around the country, you should know about Kevin Cooper, who the state of California is planning to execute in the next couple of weeks. We need to write to Governor Schwarzenegger and ask that this person, you should go to the website, I think it's, I forget the name of the website, but if you look him up on the web, it's easy to find, and you'll see Noam Chomsky and Danny Glover and all the people who are trying to stop, you know, this execution. All these executions have to be stopped. We need a moratorium. Clark, for instance, told the Miami Herald that he would consider a moratorium. He's one of the few candidates who have ventured into that area because people are very afraid to talk about the death penalty. And so, that's how I feel about this.
Michael, given that you've said you think people misconstrued what you said, would you consider changing it in your book as it's increased, you know?
I have considered that. And, you know, before I put the paper back out, I think I'll kind of clean this up a bit because we're talking about a man's life. And I think, that's how it is when you're attempting to be funny. Hopefully most of the time you're funny. Sometimes it's maybe not so funny, especially when it involves a man's life. So, that's how I feel about it.
Ten seconds.
Okay. Oh, shoot. Well, I can't get into what I was going to get into.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming out here today. Michael Moore, Academy Award winning filmmaker, did Bowling for Columbine and wrote the book Dude, Where's My Country? That's his latest book. Thank you.
Oh, thanks a lot, Amy.
If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. DemocracyNow.org is our website. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, and Rich Kim are our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Redemption songs. Redemption songs.